We have testimony on this. Is the sponsor here? Brian Rogers, would you like to come up and
I believe the commissioner is available online. It's not that Larry Dietrich would start, and then I'd follow up.
Okay. Larry, would you like to come present the DEC's point of view on this?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the commissioner was going to give the prepared remarks. I think she's on teleconference in Anchorage.
Commissioner Brown, are you on teleconference?
Yes,
sir. Could you state your name and give your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Michelle Brown, Chair of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, clearly. Thank you.
Members of the task force are extremely attentive
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate it. Senator Donnelly?
Before we proceed, I don't find the resources referral in the bill packets. It came from Resources Committee, right, this bill?
That's correct.
I think our packets are always required to have the recommendations of the prior committee included in them. I'm not here.
Thank you, Senator Donnelly. We'll check on that and see if we can get it. Senator Donnelly, we'll check on that while we go through testimony. Mr. Rogers, would you like to present the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Brian Rogers from Information Insights. I was task force facilitator. The commissioner reviewed the membership of this committee. The task force went through a very public process on how to implement the legislation that you adopted last year. The group reached unanimous agreement on the recommendations. Most of those recommendations are not statutory in nature, but rather are guidance for the department setting limits on the regulatory process. This bill before you contains the minimum changes in statute that are necessary to activate this process. Basically, three things. First, to activate the contingency planning process. Second, to limit liability for certain participants in the process, the people who act as response plan facilitators and incident management team coordinators. And third, to enable the adoption of the regulation. The recommendations contained in the report cover four basic areas: the response planning standard, the contingency plan process, the prevention, and the Alaska Railroad. The task force, in unanimously adopting the report, recommends this legislation with the attached letter of intent that appears on page 38 of the report. That letter of intent is designed to ensure that the regulatory process which would follow adoption of this legislation follows the intent of the task force. The approach chosen by the task force is a market-based approach, providing several alternative means for compliance in order to meet the needs of different sectors of the regulated industry, and provides for a phased implementation, allowing time for response and time for investment by the regulated community in those expenses necessary to meet the terms of the bill. It's my belief as a facilitator, this process shows that negotiated rulemaking can work. In this case, it worked very well, that involving industry in writing the rules for an industry together with the regulators can be a successful process. The group started with four goals that are listed on page 8 of the report: that the recommendations be realistic, effective, economically feasible, and flexible. And I believe the task force would agree that they met those four goals. I'd like to go briefly through the recommendations and then follow that with a sectional analysis, Mr. Chairman. Recommendations first, beginning with the response planning standard.
Senator Donnelly? Regarding the sectional analysis, it doesn't say who prepared it, the one in our packet.
I'm sorry, that was prepared by the Department of Law.
Committee staff, from now on, if somebody submits something like this, can we say at least who submitted it on it before we accept it? It's a section-by-section analysis, but it has no idea who's responsible for it, who authored it.
Through the chair, I would have identified it in my remarks, but I apologize that that was not provided in writing. The recommendations in the report, first on the response planning standard, the first is that a spill be controlled and contained within 48 hours of the spill. What is, and the question the task force had to decide is, what does a vessel need to show before the fact that they're able to do that? And it's a fairly simple basic standard that the vessel has sufficient boom to extend three times the length of the vessel and a means of deploying that boom. That's the initial control and containment. Second, for cleanup within a reasonable period of time, the cleanup standard is that either the vessel have under contract a skimmer in the area of its operations, or the ability to get a skimmer for the proper type of oil to that area within 24 hours. Third, on the response planning standard, the major one, what the standard is 15% of vessel capacity. a number of affected vessels came in and said, we never carry the total capacity of our vessel. If we've fueled elsewhere and come to Alaska, we may only have 60 or 70% of that. And so we've adopted in the recommendations an alternative mechanism that would allow the standard to be reduced for a vessel that's never carrying full capacity. The second area is in the contingency plan, and the contingency plan basically has three requirements. First, that the vessel has shown its financial responsibility and has a qualified individual, someone who's able to make decisions binding the company. Second, that there's a response action plan consisting of what are their procedures for notification of a spill, and that they have a contract with a primary response action contractor and a contract with an incident management team to manage a spill should one happen. And third, a certification that they meet the international maritime requirement. Now, as alternatives to the contract with a co-op or a primary response action contractor, we provided that the vessel owner may provide their own equivalent resources or can use part of their own resources and part contract resources to allow owners some flexibility in how they meet the requirement for contingency planning. In addition, the recommendations provide for a generic plan to be developed by the vessel agents for those spot charters that enter Alaska waters on short notice who are not going to be in a position to develop a whole plan in the 5 days from when they know they're coming to Alaska until they arrive. This generic plan is developed, faxed out to the vessel. The vessel owner or representative signs it, faxes it back, establishing the contract, and thus allowing the spot charter industry to continue functioning without delays in their ability to move goods from Alaska. In addition, we provided for fleet plans that might cover a group of vessels. An owner of a group of vessels or a group of like vessel owners can band together to provide their own alternative compliance. The recommendations set very tight time frames for DEC review of applications. In fact, the initial applications would be deemed acceptable and then reviewed over a cycle rather than vessels having to wait for DEC to approve them in the first place. The recommendations provide for oil spill drills and for review of compliance by DEC. The prevention section, the prevention measures are all voluntary under international maritime law. The state cannot set mandatory prevention measures, but there is a voluntary process set out with some potential rewards for vessels who undertake methods to prevent oil spills. For the Alaska Railroad, the group endorsed the railroad's risk analysis process and basically said the railroad should go through the same contingency plan process that's developed for other regulated industry. That's the basic recommendations in the report. The recommendations and really this legislation, again, is really tied to the letter of intent. The other body in committee has actually adopted that into the legislation. As a separate section, I think the task force feeling is it's really important to link, to ensure there's a link between their deliberations and that regulatory process. I'll go briefly through this sectional analysis. Sections 1 through 3 are the sections that limit the civil liability of the response action contractors. Section 4 amends the definition of response action to clarify these limitations on civil liability for incident management team services. These are companies that would manage the spill process and response plan facilitator services. These are the individuals or companies that would develop the generic plans. Section 5 relates to the proof of financial responsibility and basically makes the language for non-tank vessels identical to that for tank vessels so that we don't end up with two different standards in law. Section 6 extends the innocent passage exemptions to all of the requirements for non-tank vessel contingency plans. Basically, a vessel that is in innocent passage through Alaska waters is not held to the standards of this legislation. Section 7 adds the new provisions. This is the real guts of the contingency plan process. It sets up the sea plan process. Section 7F, and there's a delayed, there's a timed process on this. Assuming passage of legislation, if you were to pass this legislation, this legislative session, roughly a year to adopt regulations, and then 6 months following the adoption of the regulations, would be when the C-plans would be due, presumably in December of 02, January of 03. Then certain of the equipment is not due for another year and a half after that in order to allow phasing of capital expenditures. Section 7F requires the plans. 7G sets forth what the contents of those plans. 7H lays out the alternatives to having contracts. 7I extends the contingency plan provisions of existing law to the non-tank vessels. J and K are the sections relating to railroad tank cars that transport oil. And 7L is the section directing DEC to adopt the implementing regulations. Section 8 is the compliance section that allows DEC to verify compliance. Section 9 is the certification of the effective dates of the statute and the implementing regulations. The reason for that is so that since certain provisions of the bill take effect 180 days or 2 years following adoption of the regulations, that provides for notification of what those timelines are. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my prepared remarks on the task force report and the legislation. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have, or Larry Dietrich from the department is here to answer any questions that you may have concerning the fiscal note prepared by the department in response to the task force legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. I want to stick with the bill for a few moments, and then we'll go on to the fiscal note. One of the questions I had is, you have these contractors that will be part of contingency plans and the requirements. What do we have that many contractors in the state? Are we able to, is the private industry able at this time to respond to this new need that we're creating by the legislation?
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that is yes in part and coming in part. The yes in part is there are three existing oil spill cooperatives, CISPRI in Cook Inlet, Alaska Shadoo, and CPRO in Southeast Alaska. They have a phased schedule of moving into areas of Western Alaska in establishing hubs with equipment. This legislation is, and the process designed by the task force is designed to dovetail with that so that by the time this is effective, they will have equipment ready to respond in Western Alaska where they do not currently have the ability to respond or don't have all of the equipment necessary to respond to the kinds of spills we're dealing with here. In addition, if I remember right, there are 50 or 60 other response action contractors that are all have to be certified with the department that handle specific pieces of responses to oil spills. I think the general feeling is, yes, there are sufficient contractors. Some of the regulated industry may choose to become their own responders, as is allowed under this legislation.
Is there a federal sort of Damocles hanging over our head that spawned this legislation? Is there a federal requirement out there that we're trying to address with this? Or has there been a number of spills?
There have been spills. I think the department could speak to that better than I can in terms of the specific number and size of the spills. There are existing federal requirements that affect oil spill prevention and response. This is an enhancement to that within state waters that was adopted by this legislature last year.
Senator Osterman?
Yeah, in response to that, I think you said the agencies might set up their own response. Would you follow up on that?
I'm sorry, the vessels may set up their vessels or groups of vessels can set up their own response.
Okay.
So, and if I said agencies, that's an error.
Thank you.
Senator Osterman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the legislation, can you point out where it says when the contingency plans are required and when the contracts are required?
Yes, Section 7, J, page 5, line 14, is the time by which a vessel, that's for railroad, and Section F on page 4, line 7 is for marine vessels. That says that's the time at which a contingency plan has to have been filed with the department in order for a vessel or the Alaska Railroad to operate, which is 180 days after adoption of the regulations.
And do we have any indication as when that time frame would be?
We anticipate that it will, that the regulatory process will take approximately 12 months following the signing of the legislation. It has to go through the whole public process, even though most of the group has really reached agreement on what the provisions of the regulations would be, Mr. Chairman, but it does have to go through that whole public process of about 12 months.
Sometime in 2003?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, in response, January of 2003 is what we anticipate would be the date that contingency plans would be due.
And then the second part of my question, when would the contracts have to be signed?
Mr. Chairman, the contracts would have to be in place at that time. In order to have a valid contingency plan, you either need to have a contract with a response action contractor in place, or you have to certify that you have your own resources to meet the requirements.
What happens if you don't have it at that time?
If you don't
have those plans in place.
If you don't have the plans in place, then you may not operate a non-tank vessel within the waters of the state.
And what are the fines related to that? Do we know that?
I have to defer to the Attorney General's office, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Green?
I was wondering, is there either in the department or through the work of the task force a glossary of all the terms and the acronyms? Because sometimes I'm listening to this and I have to go back and think what something means. And I don't think I'm the only one in the building for whom that is a problem. And I think that might be very helpful.
Actually, I think it's not a glossary, as you said, but most of the words that I found that were buzzwords are pretty much addressed in the table of contents, kind of directing you in that way. It helps. It isn't what you're asking for.
No, I'm looking for a straight alphabetical glossary, definition, acronym, and if it's federal, state, DEC, or industry.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly understand the Senator's concern. As facilitator and someone who was not familiar with the process going in, I did develop such a glossary for myself in part of the process and can add to that and provide it to the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Rogers. At this time, Mr. Tostevin from the Attorney General Office, do you have something to add? Could you speak up just a moment, or just a bit, please? Yes, if you could, please. Tossin, sounds as if you'd be pretty motivated to comply.
Mr. Chairman, on that.
Senator Hoffman.
Do you have any idea what type of insurance rates are going to be required with these steep fines that the individual affected parties are going to be have to come up with? Seems that with these steep fines, they're going to be substantial. Are there going to be required bonding by the companies? I know that, if you're operating just a simple filling station, there's substantial bonding required because of potential spills that cause lots of pollution. And with these larger requirements, it would seem that this is going to put an additional burden, particularly on the small carriers.
Senator Donnelly?
To the witness, maybe you put your microphone a little closer so we could hear you a little more clearly, but are you saying there's insurance available to cover people for fines?
Mr. Chairman, I know it's hard to hear this witness. Perhaps I can try to answer a couple of the questions. First, the financial responsibility that's has been required since September 1st of last year under the legislation you adopted last year. Basically, each vessel, in order to operate in Alaska waters today, has to file proof of financial responsibility, basically a letter of credit indicating that they can cover the cost of the spill. So that's already in place in terms of the cost of a spill. The second question has to do with the fines for failing to file paperwork, to file the response plan, I think is different from insurance that's available in case you have a spill. Most vessels would insure against those kind of marine catastrophes. But in terms of whether insurance is available for your failing to meet administrative requirements, I don't believe that's what the assistant AG was suggesting, that someone would insure against failing to comply with law that they that has an administrative penalty. And this is the administrative penalty of $500 to $100,000 a day is what's available for penalties for failing to operate under this law, not for a spill, which has a whole separate set of calculations that you adopted some years ago.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Any other questions? Senator Ward.
Yes. On Senator Hoffman's question about insurance. So right now, in order to operate, there has to be a letter or a certification that the entity is financially able to clean up a spill today, according to the law we passed. Is that correct?
Correct.
So there's already some cost to create that document to somebody already. I mean, they have to get, is it something that they're self-certified, or is there 20% of them that are going to get to acquire some form of bonding in order to achieve that letter to operate? What has happened with that? And will this cause, whatever that cause was, to be reduced through credits?
Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Chairman, the existing letters of credit, the existing proof of financial responsibility that has been required since September 1st does impose costs on the regulated industry. I don't know what those costs are, but the cost of obtaining a letter of credit or certifying that they have the financial responsibility. What this legislation does is really cover the contingency and prevention side, which would tend to lower the cost of spills. If the regulated industry is prepared for a spill, has boom available, has skimmer available, has contractors all ready to go should there be a spill, that reduces the ultimate cost of dealing with a spill, and should over time, if one believes the free market in insurance works, should lower costs of insurance against spills because they're less likely to happen if people are prepared for them. So that this imposes, while it does impose some cost in terms of the contracts that need to be in place and the drills, et cetera, over time, the cost of preparation is that ounce of prevention really should save money compared with the cost of a spill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Dietrich, could you take us through the fiscal note, please?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. And I believe you should have a copy of our fiscal note in your packet. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The fiscal note projection, we took it out through FY 2007, and we tried to look at the steady state resources that would be required to implement this in the long run, recognizing that the task force provided for a startup window here of a couple of years. The couple of years is to, one, accommodate the promulgation of the rule that would follow here, which we would estimate as being about a 12-month process. The completion of that process then triggers the submission of the plans, which would be required to be submitted 180 days after the effective date of those regulations. And then there's another window to accommodate the capitalization of the equipment items to bring the whole thing to completion. So we basically, in Aught 3 and Aught 4, are the peak years when we would be receiving the plans. We would be doing the registering the primary response action contractors for the incident management teams, any new spill co-ops, any stevedoring companies or marine exchanges who decide to provide then the facilitation that would be required to get these plans in the door. This system is heavily dependent on the private sector resources to assemble these plans, facilitate them with the various shippers, and then get them into us. There's a training component that the task force wants us to perform to help educate the regulated community. There's the prevention credit program, and then we're also we're asked to provide for electronic posting of the contingency plans on a website. The peak years for accomplishing that work would be in Aught 3 and Aught 4. The Aught 2 amount of $78,000 is for the one position then to get started and put the regulation package together. We increased that with one additional full-time person for Aught 3 and Aught 4, and then that's backed up with two temporary positions as may be needed then to deal with that peak. We converted those to temporary so that they wouldn't linger on after we got through the review and approval process, and so they go away in Aught 5, Aught 6, and Aught 7. And two positions then, or $141,000 is what we believe to be would be the minimum cost necessary then to process approximately 500 applications, accounting for what we estimate to be around 900 vessels. The estimate on the vessels that we're using is coming from the financial responsibility requirement that was imposed in SB 273 last year, made that effective, as Brian indicated, on September 1st. And so our count is based on what we've received in the door so far, which is about 500 applications and approximately 900 vessels. We've also assumed that the bulk of these plans will be done at the private sector side in terms of the arrangements for the qualified individuals, the incident commander, essentially the response teams, and then the response resources. So we're estimating very few companies will want to develop their own. The efficiencies on this using market forces will, I think, tend to drive participation and sharing of resources the way it has done today. Our three co-ops we have in the state right now have evolved over the last 10 years, meeting the state's new oil spill requirements that were imposed in 1990, based on the needs to meet the requirements and the different ways of going about doing that. And as a result, we have three co-ops now today that provide those services. So this is really building on that backbone capability. I'm available for questions, Mr. Chairman, if anyone has any questions.
Mr. Dietrich, I'm not sure if you mentioned it in your analysis there, but the person that is brought on to promulgate the regulations, what happens to them after the regulation process has been done?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the person that would go through the rulemaking and begin those then would subsequently then become one of the reviewers of the plans.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dietrich, the funding sources using the oil spill response fund, why didn't we use a combination of user fees or some other and not wholly rely upon the oil spill response fund?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the task force did wrestle with the funding issue, and I believe it's recommendation number 31 in the report. It's one of the many different ways that the task force wanted to hold the cost down for everybody. They did make a recommendation to not have this industry be charged a user fee. So they recommended against that.
The recommendation actually suggests then that the response fund and or general funds be used. In view of the concerns over the general funds over the years, we interpret that to mean the first choice would probably be to the response fund. And so we have directed it towards that account as the funding source.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
What is the difference between user fee and an annual initiation, one-time initiation fee that's mentioned in your fiscal notes? Or the DOT's fiscal note.
Mr. Dietrich?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, I believe DOT is here if you're speaking to the DOT note, which has that. There's also a fiscal note for the Marine Highway System of $23,000, and I would defer to him on that note if your question's on that fiscal note.
Someone from the Department of Transportation, could you come up and state your name, please? Thank you, Mr. Rogers.
Chairman, I guess I'd have to rephrase my question then, Mr. Chairman.
Before you do, can we get him to state his name for the record?
Mr. Chairman, my name is George Capace. I'm the general manager of the Alaska Marine Highway System.
Thank you, Mr. Capace. Senator Hoffman?
If on one hand, with one department, we're relying upon the oil spill response fund and not on user fees, it seems as though your note is taking the opposite approach and trying to use one-time initiation fees or user fees, and why didn't your fiscal note use the oil spill response fund as well?
Through the chair, Senator, the funding source for all the contingency planning is the spill response fund for the Alaska Marine Highway System. There is, though, a fee, an initiation fee to sign up, if you will, with contracting agencies to have those resources and to join the cooperative. But our funding source in fiscal note is the 470 or the oil spill response fund.
Thank you, Mr. Pachi. Senator Ward?
Yes, was there any discussion whatsoever to have, with some oversight, but the industry to be, it appears that the solution to this is to contract out to private contractors in order to generate the facilities needed to do this because of economics of scale. Was there any discussion to contract the self-regulating out to private contractors without using any new state employees?
Mr. Dietrich?
Through fees. I might as well just rub in.
Yes, Senator Ward, through the chair. There was a heavy reliance on using the current marine infrastructure that's been created in the state for response now as the primary vehicle. The user fees, they did the discussion on at the task force then was to not charge user fees for the regulated community for participating.
And why was that? Mr. Chairman, if I might, why was that?
The task force, one of the goals, as Brian indicated, of the task force is the affordability of the whole package for the regulated industry. And so the piece about charging a user fee to pay then for the cost to implement the program was discussed, and the recommendation of the task force was that this would be another way that they can keep the cost down to the industry by not charging a user fee. And so they recommended against that.
Chairman, is there analysis on that? Do you have that?
Mr. Deacon.
Yes, Senator Ward, through the chair. To the extent the documentation for that, it's included in the task force report, and then that's backed up by the transcript of the proceeding, and that's where the entire discussion will be recorded, and that's available.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ward. You know, I'd like to break for just a moment from this discussion on the fiscal note. My apologies. There were two people that wanted to testify on the bill itself, and I'd like to get that out of the way because we're going to have to probably hear this bill later. If I could get that testimony now, if Mr. Britton and Ms. Schrader, to save time, if you could come up to the podium, and then we'll take your testimony one at a time, please. If you could, Ms. Schrader, if you could state your name for the record and give your testimony, please.
Chairman Kelly, members of the committee, my name is Susan Schrader. I am representing Alaska Conservation Voters today, and I believe you have a very brief position paper in front of you. Our 44-member organizations currently represent about 35,000 registered Alaskan voters, and ACV, as well as several of our member organizations, have closely followed SB 273, the work of the task force, and now the efforts of these two bills making it through the legislature this year. We are pleased with the efforts of the task force, and we support the requirements of SB 16 that non-tank vessels and the railroad need to establish spill response planning. So we are supportive of the bill, and we hope that you will support it also.
Thank you, Ms. Schrader. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Britton?
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'm Eric Britton, Manager of Planning and Development for CSX Lines. Many of us are still trying to call us Sealand. However, we're making the transition here. I was a member of the task force created by 273 and SCR1. In particular, I chaired, co-chaired the prevention subcommittee. But this was the first I had to serve on a legislatively created task force, and certainly the first opportunity for me to see negotiated rulemaking in progress. And I have to say, this is just a phenomenal process. I understand there is a degree of concern about a lack of opposition to this particular bill and the regulations. And whether that's true or not, I think the way that all parties came to the table, legislative being represented by Senator Pierce and Representative Cott, the regulatory end and the users, to watch the interaction was pretty phenomenal. I don't mean that there weren't some red faces and a little bit of perhaps high blood pressure during the process, but I think that the report that you have before you is indicative of where we arrived, and it was by consensus, as Mr. Rogers indicated. It took a lot of hard work, a lot of time, but a lot of time, a lot of late evenings and weekends to work through this. The members of the task force were very dedicated. But I think that the result, again, is consensus of the task force. It's awfully nice to hear members of the conservation community supporting this. I personally received several emails from the Alaska Center for the Environment during the process commending my subcommittee, the prevention subcommittee, and I have to tell you, sometimes when you sit in my chair and you get a letter from the Alaska Center for the Environment telling you you're doing a good job, it sort of makes you stop and think. But I think that's more an evidence of the fact that you know, we just had the process working here. It's really excellent. So I think the regulations that have been proposed and the legislation are focused on cost, and I'd certainly like to ask for the committee's support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Britton. At this time, we have a session coming up anyway. Let's bring up this bill at a later date. Mr. Rogers, I know you have a bit of a travel problem. We are not scheduled for bills previously heard on Friday. It may require a motion on the floor to waive the rules, and we'll see how the committee and other people's schedules go to see if we have to do that either for Friday or Monday, but I'll try to accommodate your schedules as best as possible. Thank you for your testimony. We'll get back to the fiscal notes when we hear this bill again. Meeting is adjourned.